Hey guys, how's it going? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And it should be a good show lined up for you today. Mark Thornton is going to be on to talk about the drug wars. And so that should be really good. He's got a great new piece at Mises.org you're going to want to look at. And also, Susanna George is going to be on the show to talk about this article I mentioned to you yesterday. America is building a Sunni army in Iraq to take on the Islamic State. It's kind of a complicated mess, but we'll get into what it all means with her on the show here in a little while. Also, news. I got plenty. And in fact, I think in the last... Oh, no, yeah, we're going to probably have Jason Ditz on. I forgot about that. We got to have Jason on the show to talk about this Korea thing, which, you know, I really resent America. Well, I don't know. The corporate owners of all the theater chains and their insurance companies for making this a news story that I actually have to pay attention to at all. Man, I don't care about a bunch of Hollywood crap. I don't even care about a Sony hack. At all, really. Other than they checked with the State Department and made sure it was a good idea to have a plot where the CIA sends these guys to kill the dictator of North Korea. So that's interesting. The State Department gave a good thumbs up to that. Otherwise, man, I don't care. I don't believe for a minute that North Korea is behind the hack or any of this. And I'm embarrassed for our entire society that this movie is being delayed because of a pretended threat of who? North Korean terrorist sleeper cells in America attacking movie theaters in the middle of nowhere town for playing this stupid comedy movie with Seth, whatever his name is? Are you kidding me? America. Anyway, I don't want to care at all, except I have to. I'm sure probably most of you guys are in the same boat. Been trying hard not to pay attention to that story. But Jason Ditz, he does the work, so we don't have to. I'm going to have him on the show, and he's going to explain, in particular, exactly how ridiculous this all is. Jason Ditz from news.antiwar.com. Thank goodness for him. And actually, that's not firmed up yet, but should be. Chances are we'll have Jason on at the end of the show. Okay, so here's what I got to say. You like the show? Are you one of those people who's been listening for weeks or months or years? And you think to yourself sometimes, wow, this guy's always predicting the future pretty accurately. Boy, he's been talking about Jeb Bush running for president for years now, hasn't he? Boy, he's been calling the rise of the ridiculous Islamo-fascist caliphate that never existed, that was a figment of George Bush and Osama bin Laden's imagination, coming to life in real life for a full year before it happened. More. I wrote my article for FFF.org, Stupidity or the Plan. That came out, well, it was written in April of 2013. And I said in there, blam, look, they just renamed al-Nusra, and this was in between the fighting, the faction fighting between al-Nusra and ISIS. This was just with the breaking news that Nusra has just renamed itself the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. And then I already knew that, hey, there is no ruling power in Western Iraq to stop them. It's the rise of the Islamo-fascist caliphate come to life in real life. I wrote back a year and 3 months before it happened, and the declaration of the caliphate and all that. Whatever. Anyway. And I'm not much for speculating, really. I just like pointing out what's going on. And not too much gets by me. Really, mostly because of Eric and Jason Ditz at antiwar.com. They make sure that I know everything. But anyway, if you appreciate the show for what it is, you should help support it and make sure that it can continue to exist. You know, I don't know. There are costs. This equipment is wearing out. Some of this stuff has got to be replaced. Plus, the electricity's got to get paid. The long-distance bill's got to get paid. the cost of the office space. It's a fraction of my rent, if you want to look at it that way. There are costs to me doing this show instead of having a real job. And Liberty Radio Network is a great little radio network, but it's not a giant professional thing that pays me millions of dollars a year to come and be so right about everything all the time, or even anything at all. They provide a great opportunity for me to exploit to the degree that I'm able, but that's it. So, it's up to my advertisers and you. And those could be the same thing. I need advertisers to help keep this show going. Just email me scott@scotthorton.org and we'll talk about it. I work pretty cheap. I'm trying to add up cheap times a lot equals some. That makes sense, right? Mathematical-wise, multiplication tables. So, you know, if you have a nonprofit, any kind of anti-war group or anything like that, or, you know, like the Future Freedom Foundation or the Council for the National Interest, or if, you know, like a go-kart galaxy, you sell motorcycle and go-kart parts, or you got a book that you wrote, or whatever it is you want me to help plug it on the show, let me know. Scott@scotthorton.org. I'm sure we can work it out. You can help keep this show going, and I can help you get rid of some of the stuff you're selling there. How about that? Scott@scotthorton.org. And then for the rest of you, you can still sign up and donate. I give away all the MP3 archives for free. I always have for the last 12 years running now, since the Philip Drew interview started. But you can pretend it costs money and then pay me whatever you're willing to pay for it. How about that? For access to 3,500 interviews going back to 2003, the libertarian anti-foreign policy view on all American foreign policies ever since then. I got a tweet from a guy a couple weeks ago, said he's about halfway through the archives. He's working through them all. I get that from time to time. People who decide, man, I like this show, I'm going to go back and listen to every interview on this page. Wow. All right. Those of you who love the show so much, help support. That way the show can continue. How about that? Okay, good. That's all I got to say about that other than the address. ScottHorton.org/donate. ScottHorton.org/donate. Or in fact, ScottHorton.org/support. I'm not sure if I ever quite finished that page. I think I did. And there's a bookstore at my website. There's a link to Amazon. If you do your Christmas shopping, I guess it's too late now if you didn't already know, but whatever, or maybe you do your Christmas shopping on the 26th. I don't know. Whatever shopping you do at Amazon.com, just stop by scotthorton.org/Amazon or click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page there, and I'll get a cut from their end of the sale, which is nice. And for God's sake, man, patronize my sponsors. I got Whole Food Multi-Complete Vitamins. I got Darren's Coffee, the Future Freedom Journal of the Future Freedom Foundation, which you ought to subscribe to and help support. Phil Giraldi's great group, the Council for the National Interest in Washington, D.C., called the Antidote to the Israel Lobby. And of course, there's Roberts & Roberts Brokerage Company. There is Wall Street Window Investment Advice and the great book, The War State by Michael Swanson. Probably the greatest part of my legacy on this earth, LibertyStickers.com. I didn't make up all of them, but I did make up most of them. LibertyStickers.com and TheBumperSticker.com. I don't own them companies no more, but they do help support the show. And I hope I'm not leaving anybody out. Did I say Darren's Coffee? Drink Darren's Coffee. It's good. And listen, it's free shipping. Free shipping, which is a lot. I mean, you get just a bag of coffee, that's saving you $6 on one bag of coffee. You get free shipping if you use the promo code Scott Horton. So that's a pretty damn good deal for some really high quality coffee from all over the world. Premium grade stuff there. So if you're a coffee drinker, then help support the show and drink great coffee at the same time, darrenscoffee.com. And yeah, patronize my sponsors. Become one. Scott@scotthorton.org. Bad news in just a sec. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show. Like I say, Mark Thornton coming up on the show, as well as Susanna George, and I'm hoping and I'm pretty confident Jason Ditz will be on as well. You know what? I need you to listen to the soundbite real quick so I can go turn off the heater, because I know that's causing some buzz in the background. Now, of course, it's going to take a second to go Windows.
The point, very simple, was this. We knew the Soviets were already conducting operations in Afghanistan. We knew there was opposition in Afghanistan to the progressive effort which was being made by the Soviets to take over. And we felt, therefore, it made a lot of sense to support those who were resisting. And we decided to do that. This, of course, probably convinced the Soviets even more to do what they were planning to do, which was to try to make a general takeover of the country by force of arms, and got them embroiled in an adventure which proved disastrous for them.
In the same interview, you were asked whether you regretted having supported Islamic fundamentalists and having armed future terrorists. Your reply was, what is more important in the history of the world, the Taliban or the collapse of the Soviet Empire and the end of the Cold War? Do you still stand by this statement?
It sounds like a very free translation of a comment regarding the importance of the Taliban. The Taliban itself wasn't very important. What was important was the fact that the Soviets pulverized Afghanistan, really destroyed it and polarized it, and subsequently produced the circumstances which are still confronting us in Afghanistan and that part of the world. But the fact that the Soviets became involved in an adventure which they could not win was positive from the standpoint of the West. Don't forget, the Soviets were busy training terrorists all over the place in the 80s. They had camps all over the Soviet Union for terrorist activity. Can you imagine what the world would be like today if there was still a Soviet Union? So yes, compared to the Soviet Union and to its collapse, the Taliban were unimportant.
Funny. And of course, what he said in that original interview that she's quoting was, what's more important, some stirred up Muslims? Which wasn't just the Taliban, it seemed more like a reference to Al-Qaeda. Stirred up ones, huh? What's more important, some stirred up Muslims or the end of the Soviet Union? Sounded much more like a reference to international Al-Qaeda terrorism than to local backwoods Taliban hillbillies to me. But anyways, Zbigniew Brzezinski for you there, covering for me while I went to shut off the heater, which was making too much noise. Was keeping me warm. It was also making too much noise. Okay. So, I don't even know where I want to start today. Let's start with the cops. You got to see this. I can't stop talking about this. I can't stop thinking about it. I can't stop tweeting it over and over again. So, there's this guy, Chris Hayes, on MSNBC, but it was this other guy, Ari Melber, was filling in for him. I'm not sure if you're familiar. And he interviewed Jeffrey Fulmer, the head of the Cleveland Police Union. And the guy just got up there. Well, first of all, the reason he was interviewing him was because this football player wore a shirt that said Justice for Tamir Rice and John Crawford on it. Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old boy murdered by a cop a few weeks ago for having a BB gun on him. And John Crawford also murdered for having a BB gun by a cop in Ohio. Was that in Cleveland, too? Or was that in Columbus? I guess maybe that was in Cleveland, too. Anyway, both of these one was a boy, a 12-year-old boy. The other was a very young man. Both of them black. Both of them killed for holding a BB gun. And so this guy, Fulmer, put out a statement ridiculing this football player and demanding an apology for saying that he wants justice. And then, I don't know if you saw The Daily Show last night, they had the great clip of this guy's awesome statement on, hey, justice just means the bad get punished and the good are protected and this and that kind of thing. It was this, you know, perfect, law school level kind of statement about the common understanding of how things are supposed to work around here. And he said, yeah, I was raised by my mom to respect police. I was also raised to understand that some police are just going to hate you for what you look like and who you are, no matter what, and you have to be careful of them and whatever. And that's just the fact of the matter. And anyway, so this pig is saying, who in the hell is this N-word to think that he can comment on cops killing other N-words in the neighborhood? And his answer is as good of an answer back as you could possibly get about exactly what right it is of him to comment on cops killing people in his town and how he has to raise a son and has to fear that his son is going to be end up being killed by a cop for no good reason and all this. Awesome statement. So MSNBC guy has the pig on the show, and you just got to see it. I mean, I can't even describe it. I could play it for you, but it's too damn long. It's but it's at libertycrier.com. Bookmark it for later or whatever. Cleveland Police Union chief calls killing of 12-year-old justified. And he's just, oh, there's no question about it. And he even says, and I don't know if this is a fact, but probably it is. He says, the prosecutor has already cleared the cop in this case. The kid had what looked like a gun. And they make such a big deal about the orange tip had been removed. But he didn't point it at them, so they had no way of knowing whether it had an orange tip on it or not yet. This cop's actual theory is, if someone has a gun, then a cop can kill him. That's funny, because I thought 150 million Americans own guns. 150 million Americans own guns. Approximately 300 million firearms, one for every American, owned legally in private hands by law-abiding American citizens in this country. But if someone has a gun, then it is perfectly okay to take their life, simple as that, beyond dispute, beyond argument. Even if it's a 12-year-old boy, even if it turns out it wasn't a gun, it was a toy gun. Hey, he had a gun. So the cop was, of course, perfectly justified. But, of course, you aren't allowed to kill anyone just because they are holding a gun. Are you? You'd be arrested, if not shot, by these guys in the process of pretending to try to arrest you to put you on trial for such a thing. You can't shoot somebody just because they have a gun. You can only shoot them if they are using it to present an immediate and credible threat to your life or another innocent life. Scientific fact. But watch this police union thug. Get on there. And just, yeah, of course he had the right to kill Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old boy with a BB gun. Beyond question. And Jeffrey Fulmer, that's Jeffrey Fulmer. Who's the football player? I don't know the football player's name. But he refuses to back down and says how dare this football player, you know, a citizen, a resident of Cleveland, presume to have a comment about cops' behavior. Only cops are allowed to comment on what cops do. LibertyCrier.com. You gotta see it. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Check out the archives at scotthorton.org. I got more than 3,500 interviews now going back to 2003. Next up is Mark Thornton. He is a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Ludwig von Mises Institute. They're at Mises.org in Auburn, Alabama. And he's got this great new article from yesterday. The War on Drugs was born 100 years ago. Welcome back to the show, Mark. How are you doing?
Hey, Scott. I'm doing great, and it's wonderful to be back on your show. And, you know, we've kind of dropped the Ludwig von Mises Institute, and we're going with just the Mises Institute, just so we don't have to stumble over our own name.
There you go. Well, I've said it wrong all along until Deist told me. No, it's Ludwig. Ludwig. Okay, well, what the hell do I know? I'm a Texan, man. I can't pronounce things right. All right. The Mises Institute, named for Ludwig von Mises, author of Human Action and A Theory of Money and Credit and Bureaucracy and Socialism and so many other great books that changed the history of the world. So Mises.org is where you find this. This is Mises Daily. Is the blog there. The war on drugs was born 100 years ago. Now I'll shut up and let you tell the horrible story.
Well, Scott, you know, Ludwig von Mises, when you mentioned his book, Human Action, he said in there that, you know, a state can try to prohibit the consumption of things like tobacco and alcohol, but the problem is trying to get the whole thing done. And then an even bigger problem is, what is to prevent a state from banning bad books or bad pictures or anything else? And, you know, he was right. The war on drugs started off sort of simple, nondescript. Nobody really heard about it very much. There was no real social concern to a great extent about things like narcotics and cocaine and heroin at the time. It wasn't really a big deal. But because of political pressure and because of racist attitudes and bigotry, they went ahead and passed the Harrison Narcotics Act 100 years ago. It wasn't even an outright prohibition. It was simply a measure to tax and to register and to make sure that the government knew who was prescribing these drugs and who was taking these drugs, and they wanted to discourage use by putting a tax on it. But shortly thereafter, the bureaucrats who were in charge of this tax act decided that it was not proper medical practice for doctors to prescribe narcotics for addiction treatment. There were, you know, doctors who specialized in addiction, and usually they would start by prescribing the drug in lower and lower doses. Or you could go to a clinic, an addiction clinic, and they would do the same thing and sort of wean you off the drugs and to provide substitutes and counseling and so forth. But the bureaucrats decided otherwise, and the courts went along with them. So all of a sudden you had the court system and the bureaucrats in the Treasury Department deciding what is and what is not proper medical practice.
Now, hold it right there for just a moment. Before we get on to the enforcement of this, I'd like to ask, go back a step to the passage of the act in the first place and the motivation for its creation. Now, other than being signed by the noted white supremacist monster Woodrow Wilson to become a law, what did race have to do with it, really?
Oh, well, I mean, there was racist hysteria and yellow journalism that were fueling this. Of course, the Chinese immigrants, they smoked opium, and so that was, you know, that was considered evil, and we didn't want the Chinese coming into this country. And then stories were being told about black men taking cocaine and being impervious to bullets, being extremely violent, and raping white women. So these were the types of stories that were circulating with respect to these drugs. And then, of course, marijuana or cannabis was being smoked by Mexican migrant workers and black jazz musicians in New Orleans. And so that was painted as, you know, totally verboten and, you know, and very bad for society. Certainly doesn't fit in with white Anglo-Saxon Protestant mentality or mores. And so there was a racist bigotry hysteria painted, you know, with respect to these particular drugs. And so you had that side of it. You also had the diplomatic side of it, where the U.S. politicians and diplomats wanted America to become a world power and world player in diplomatic affairs. We had won the Spanish-American War. So the U.S. was a world economic power, and they wanted to make it a world military and diplomatic power. And so They organized the Opium Convention Conference, is starting in 1909, when the whole idea was the U.S. was stepping forth and taking charge, and the issue was controlling the opium trade. Mm-hmm. And when it was coming around for, you know, final passage and all that stuff, the U.S. hadn't done anything domestically to control the opium trade. And so this Harrison Narcotics Act was quickly put together and passed in December of 1914. So you had the diplomatics and warmongers on the one side and racists and bigots on the other hand. Nobody was really truly concerned with addicts and the care of addicts and drug abuse and things of that nature. It wasn't that at all. It was racism, bigotry, and warmongering.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that, you know, we're all raised, I think, I mean, I learned in government school about how prohibition just didn't work. It could have never worked. And they realized that it was the wrong thing to try to do and so corrected their terrible mistake when it came to prohibition of alcohol. But I guess when it comes to so-called illicit drugs, the thing of it is it's such a small percentage of the population, whoever does cocaine, well, and especially the ones who can afford black market powder cocaine are always rich and white enough to not have to go to jail anyway. It's not there, you know, doesn't become a problem for them. But, you know, otherwise society wide, nobody really has a positive connection to anyone who's a recreational heroin user or whatever. You know what I mean? It's a very marginalized part of society. And so everyone else just doesn't care what happens to them, no matter if the economics of prohibition are just as stupid as the economics of alcohol prohibition when it comes to heroin. They're not the ones being affected. They're not the ones having to sneak out to a speakeasy and be afraid of having to go to jail to go get a drink. And so they don't really care.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, the fact that the population that has consumed these illegal drugs is relatively small, and it hasn't really changed much over time. It has gotten bigger during the war on drugs, but it's not like the majority of the people have actually experienced these drugs. And so they're very susceptible to propaganda. And basically, if you go back through the last 100 years, what you're going to hear and see is a lot of propaganda. And, you know, they had the Reefer Madness campaign, which put out posters and movies and fed journalists stories that were patently untrue regarding the impact of marijuana on the consumers. And it was said that marijuana could kill you, that marijuana would cause you to be violent, and that, you know, all sorts of things that you would, that marijuana would make people want to rape other people. You know, just horrific stories about what marijuana does. And they used that to pass the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937.
Now, we'll pick up on the other side of this break with that, because I want to ask you all about that. But shades of this, just in the recent crisis, Mike Brown was high on marijuana, and it bulked up to run through the bullets with its demonic powers, said Darren Wilson, in front of the grand jury, and got away with murder. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, guys, welcome back. Goddamn breaks interrupting my interviews. I'm talking with Mark Thornton from the Mises Institute, Mises.org, where they understand economics for real, not a bunch of nonsense. And we're talking about the drug wars, and there's so much still here to cover, and I definitely want to get back to Anslinger and the 30s, Wilson and Roosevelt, the evil drug warriors. I got to segue back there, get back to that segue, what you mentioned there about all the propaganda about, oh, blacks use drugs, and you know how they are when they get on drugs. And this is exactly the kind of things that we're hearing right now in the present day, as I couldn't help but mention there about Mike Brown, how, yes, oh, he became bulletproof Somehow he died of the bullet wounds anyway. But anyway, yeah, he was bulletproof at the time. And I can't help but mention a couple things here and set you up and see what you think of this. First of all, just I have to comment on the horrible irony of watching this new documentary by Stacy Peralta of Pal Peralta Skateboards about the Crips and the Bloods in L.A. It's a real tragic kind of a thing. And, of course, it's all wrapped up in the drug wars. And then it's next, Drug Wars on the Fusion Channel. And then they go straight into basically it's cops, but it's international drug war cops. And the clip is, this is a $95 billion a year business. And then they show some short clips of these cops making the slightest dent in it, just enough to drive the prices up. But otherwise, you know, really just creating a situation where these criminals thrive and completely ignorant of their own guilt and complicity in the way the system works. They're so self-righteous, it's unreal. It's like something out of U.S. Senate, these cops with their good works that they're accomplishing. But then, so to get back to the thing about the domestic police state here, the war on drugs in the United States, and of course, if you're a member of a minority group in America, it sure as hell looks like a race war to you, the white majority and their cops and their state against black and brown minorities. Look at the prison statistics. As you say in your article here, there's just no way around the fact of it. But here's what I'm not seeing in the midst of this giant crisis over Mike Brown and Eric Garner and these massive nationwide protests against police abuse. I don't see black ministers and black civil rights leaders saying we have to legalize drugs. And I know why. It's because they're ministers, for crying out loud. And ministers don't want to legalize drugs. That's like saying drugs are okay. And so my question for you, really, if I can finally put this rant in the form of a question mark, is what can the Mises Institute do? What can you guys do to get what can libertarians do, if you can advise the rest of us, to make it okay for people to go ahead, drop the moralizing, and make the economic argument that, you know what, crack is devastating to a neighborhood. Crack plus a local police force war on the crack trade is worse by 10, and we have to just stop it. And there's some progress on pot, but the idea of just polite people in polite society saying, legalize heroin, empty the prisons, legalize cocaine, let them do cocaine if they want to. No one's brave enough to say that in polite society yet. And it's the only answer to the problem of the militarization and the victimization of the people by the militarized police in this country is the war on drugs. And slowly beginning to legalize a little bit of weed, you know, is not cutting it, is what I'm trying to get at. But so what can be done to get this message across to the leaders who need to put it at the top of their list of demands? You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean, Scott. But let's be clear to the audience. Marijuana does not make people violent. It makes them nonviolent. And this war on drugs has been about racism and bigotry and controlling minorities from the very beginning, and it's the same way today. You know, if you look at the black, white, and Hispanic populations, they all smoke marijuana at about the same rates, and they also use hard drugs at about the same rates. And yet, there's about, I think it's 9 times the relative number of African Americans in prison for drugs. 6 or 7 times the relative number of Hispanics in prison for drugs compared to white people. So this war on drugs was at least partially about racism and bigotry from the very beginning, and it shows up precisely in the prison population statistics today. And so that's a major factor, that this is a racist and bigoted war that's unwinnable. Now, as far as getting rid of the war on drugs, I'm very optimistic. And when I say the war on drugs, I don't mean just medical marijuana and recreational marijuana. I think we've made a lot of progress in that direction. But when I ask people, you know, do you think it's an effective way to treat or deal with addiction and drug abuse by using police officers and prison guards, or do you think it'd be better if you used doctors, counselors, and social pressure, economic pressure, to deal with the problems of addiction? And now all the polite people of white society, if I put that question to them, they all agree now that even with the hard drugs, that, you know, doctors, counselors, social pressure, economic pressure, job pressure, those are much more effective uses. And the use of police and prison guards is completely ineffective. It doesn't work at all. It's like burning, it's effectively, one professor said early on when he looked at the early drug war, which wasn't that big, he said, this is the same sort of treatment that people did when they burned witches at the stake. You know, that's about the same type of treatment they're getting. And I would also add that, you know, at the Institute, we, of course, have been fighting this battle since the very beginning. There's now a lot of other groups that have joined in, including law enforcement against prohibition, and even Pat Robertson, the Reverend Pat Robertson, the white Reverend Evangelical Pat Robertson, says that we need to end this war on drugs and that we have to specifically legalize marijuana. So I think we're at the point now where the vast majority of Americans certainly want medical marijuana legalized. They want marijuana legalized for recreational purposes, and they want some other way of dealing with the harder drugs, such as the medical approach or the commercialization approach. So I'm optimistic.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I sure like to hear optimistic words along those lines. I used to think that back in 2008 and 2012, when Ron Paul was running, that he should have, you know, got his people to somehow call together as big a meeting of black Protestant ministers as he could possibly get together in one place and preach to them the Austrian economics case against prohibition. And of course, work in a lot of argument about how legalizing it is not the same as saying it's okay. It's the furthest thing from that. It's just a recognition of reality here. And this needs to become at the top of y'all's priorities. The more conservative you are, the more against drugs you are, the more against the drug war you need to be. We need a real change. Like you said, hey, if Pat Robertson can get this straight, which he took it back because someone said, yeah, but I knew a guy who had a problem with drugs one time. And he said, oh, a problem with drugs. Oh, whoops. I didn't mean to make sense for a minute there and took it back. But anyway, if he could do it for a minute, then, you know, rational people, especially people representing the quite unfairly, as you mentioned, burdened black community, ought to be able to put this front and center. And that's the only thing that's really going to make the change, is for people who, like Ron Paul, are so square that you know that this guy has never even, I think he even said he's not even sure if he's ever smelled marijuana before. He's the perfect guy to make that kind of case. Same thing for all the black Protestant ministers. They're the perfect guys to make the case that the war on drugs is destroying our communities worse than the drugs. So stop it now.
Yeah. And the economic case, Scott, that I've been making for a long time, is that it's the war on drugs itself, law enforcement, putting people in jail, putting smugglers and dealers at risk of going to jail and, you know, having all sorts of penalties on them. That's what makes them want to smuggle and sell highly potent marijuana, and that's what makes them want to switch from dealing in marijuana to dealing in things like cocaine, crack, heroin, methamphetamines, and ecstasy and other drugs that are smaller and more compact. And when people hear that, I mean, if I can get to talk to 300 million people, eventually everybody's going to get the idea that the worst excesses in drug abuse in our society, the overdoses, the emergency room visits, the deterioration of your health and mental status, all of that is primarily driven by the war on drugs itself. If we had, you know, companies, firms, Walmart, you know, Bayer, you know, the drug pharmaceutical companies making and selling these products, they couldn't put out deadly products. Otherwise, they'd be sued and lose the zillions of dollars. And so I'm working on right now trying to show people what the free market would look like if we legalized all the drugs, including the hard drugs.
Well, just think about the life of a drug addict, too, where, you know, take the best case scenario. Somebody had a terrible injury, an auto accident or something, and they're in terrible pain, and they were on good painkillers in the hospital. Then they got kicked right out of the hospital, and then they ended up hooked on heroin, something like that. Well, so now you're talking about somebody who's just a normal person who's being forced to participate in a drug underworld and all this criminality, when in fact he could just go to Walgreens and get some heroin or get some, you know, whatever opiate in a brown paper bag, and it could have stapled to it a flyer for like, hey man, if you're really addicted to this stuff and you're hitting rock bottom, call this number and we can help you. I mean, why in the world should somebody, just because they have a drug problem doesn't mean they're a bad person, doesn't mean that they should force to have to deal with bad people. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and so-called regular people now are finding themselves in that position where they get cut off from the Oxycontin and the Vicodin, and then they realize they can't possibly afford $30 a pill in the black market. And so they said, well, give me some heroin. It's only $5, and it'll get me through. And then they end up getting on heroin.
Yeah.
And that is
hey,
know,
true story, path. Man. That happens a lot. That happens a lot. I remember seeing this, the one episode of Dog the Bounty Hunter I ever saw. Oh, we're going to hunt this bastard down. Oh, we're going to hunt this dog down. Rah, rah, rah. And then they get him, and it's just some poor Joe who got hooked on heroin because of his chronic pain. That's all. It's just some guy, you know? And then even Dog the Bounty Hunter's like, well, sorry, I'm still taking you to jail, but but I guess I realize now that, sorry, I roughed you up so bad there. You seemed like a decent guy. Blah, blah, but. It's anyway, just a small slice of, you know, I got one small anecdote for you here, too. I had a science teacher in high school who would go out and break the law every night providing clean needles to drug addicts in Austin, Texas. And he could have gotten real trouble for it. But he would go out there and he'd be like, look, guys, I'm a biologist, okay? Let me tell you about HIV. This is a serious thing. Please use these clean needles. And he would give them all needles as best as he could. And he would tell us about it, and it was like, you know, it's like the kind of thing of somebody talking about an underground magazine in East Germany during communism or something, right? A secret mission to go give clean needles to addicts to prevent the spread of AIDS in our society.
And, you know, Scott, there's a million sad stories out there just like that, and most Americans don't know it. And if they did, and if they thought about it hard enough, I think that they'd realize that what we've done in this country, they're going to look back in 100 years, and they're going to look at us and say, these were some of the most bizarre creatures that have ever inhabited this planet, and so full of themselves and so full of the notion that they think that they could, you know, obliterate addiction by using police and prison guards. And we're going to look pretty bad in historical retrospect, because the war on drugs is going to be lost, and we are going to get our freedom back. It's, in my opinion, only a matter of time that we'll realize that what a stupid thing we've done, what a harmful thing we've done, and something we can never, ever be forgiven for.
Yep. All right, y'all. That's Mark Thornton. He's at Mises.org, the Mises Institute for Austrian Economics. The article is called The War on Drugs Was Born 100 Years Ago. And there's also text of a great interview here with the Mises Institute, an international view of drug prohibition, about his debate at Oxford University, at the Oxford Union debates, which is also great. So thanks very much, Mark, for coming back on the show. I sure appreciate it. And I promise we'll get to Harry Anslinger and the rest of those guys the next time.
Thanks, Scott. I enjoyed it a great deal. And, do check out that. Thanks for the plug of the article. End of the interview of the Oxford Union debates.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, is there video of the debate itself now?
No, we'll have to do a whole show on that. The mystery of the debate.
The mystery of the debate. All right. Maybe next week. Let's catch up.
Sounds great, Scott. Take care.
Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it. All right, y'all. We'll be right back with Susanna George in just a moment.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Phew, I got here just in time for the bumper music. Went a little overtime with Mark Thornton there. You're going to want to hear the end in the archives, I think, maybe. Okay, next up is Susanna George, writing for the Global Post. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Hey there. I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me.
Very happy to have you here. A very important article that you've written. Very interested to hear you tell the story. It's called America is Building a Sunni Army in Iraq to take on the Islamic State, somewhat of an attempt to redo the awakening movement of 2006 and 7, I presume, only as you describe here, without much cooperation from the government in Baghdad. First of all, let me ask you this. You say the base is just outside of Mosul, and that made me wonder, well, how far outside of Mosul? On the Kurdish side of the line, or really just outside of Mosul, or how's that work?
Well, it was just a few kilometers from the front lines, and you did have to pass through a Kurdish checkpoint to get to this base, mm-hmm. and it was in this kind of no man's land that exists all around Mosul now, between the Kurdish-controlled parts of northern Iraq and then the actual front lines where there's fighting going on with the Islamic State.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then so you have here General Khaled al-Hamdani. Now, who's he? What's his background?
Well, al-Hamdani was the chief of all of the police in Nineveh province before Mosul fell. He worked very closely with the Americans when U.S. forces were in Iraq during the U.S.-led occupation. And he wants the U.S. to come back in a similar fashion to help his men out yet again, fight the Islamic State. He says that he speaks very highly of the Americans. He called the United States serious, and he expects that his men would get the kind of help that he says they need if they're going to take on the Islamic State from the United States before they get it from their own government in Baghdad.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then so I know it's complicated. I don't even know how to ask the question right, really. But what exactly could you describe the relationship between him and his collection of police officers or former police officers and the tribes from that area? Is he a member or a kind of a high-ranking member of a local tribe, or he's allied with local Sunni tribes? How many people is he counting as his ranks here?
Mm-hmm. Well, he says that he has, 6,000 men under his command. I saw a few hundred at the base. So there's definitely a discrepancy there in mm-hmm. figures. Where you actually see Sunni tribes playing an important role would be a little bit further south in the west of Iraq in Anbar province. In Mosul, it really is these kind of former security officials like Hamdani and his men, who are the who the U.S. believes will be the backbone of this force that will eventually try to take back territory from the Islamic State.
Mm-hmm. Well, and boy, the way you describe it, I don't know, it's almost like a Mel Brooks kind of thing. The American, the CIA guys drive away and everybody relaxes and starts smoking Lucky Strikes and joking around. They've got nothing to fight with, and they're talking about taking a city of, a couple of million people with, I don't know how many Islamic State fighters in it, but it seems like the Islamic State has Mosul pretty locked down. Did it seem to you like, yeah, okay, these guys might be able to, launch a major assault on Mosul in X many months, or is this just ridiculous, or what are we looking at here?
Well, I mean, it's really hard to assess their capabilities, but I think I quoted in the piece that Hamdani said that, yeah, no worries. As long as we get the weapons that we need, we'll have Mosul back in a month. I find that very hard to believe. Remember, these are the same people who fled their posts in June when the Islamic State first attacked Mosul. So we're dealing with people who are operating at that level of command and control dedication to what they're fighting for. So that's kind of like your base starting point. What they say, what Iraqi officials say, is give us the weapons and we'll be able to do the fighting. But the problem right now is that no one is willing to arm these men because, as I mentioned earlier, these are the same people that not only did they flee in the face of combat with the Islamic State, but many of them left their weapons behind, which is why the Islamic State is so well armed now. Right. They confiscated, they were able to pick up a lot of weaponry when they took Mosul that the Iraqi army and security forces left behind. And also there's just this deep distrust between Baghdad, which is dominated by a Shia government, which is, seems very, very powerful right now, especially with all of the influence that Iran has gained as they've helped Baghdad in the fight against the Islamic State, and the country's Sunni community that's been alienated by years of increasingly increasingly sectarian policies by the country's former prime minister, Nouri al-Maliki. Abadi has made some improvements in that arena, but he has a long way to go. And you can tell that the distrust remains because the weapons just aren't getting there to these Sunni fighters from Baghdad.
Right. Yeah. Well, man, there's so much to go over here. I wonder if, does it look to you, I mean, obviously Abadi is also just a member of the Dawah party like Maliki and Jafari before him. Jafari, now the foreign minister. Does it seem like he's even interested in doing this? Because it sounds like what we're talking about is replicating the failed attempt to meet the benchmarks of 2007. Everybody said the surge worked, but they never measured it by the benchmarks that were set out in the first place, which was the one of the primary, you know, points of the whole exercise was to get the Shiite-run Baghdad government to go ahead and pay these guys to be the army and the local security forces in their own areas anyway, and yet they had no interest in doing that whatsoever. People pin it all on Maliki, but it seemed like America gave him Baghdad. They didn't care. They said, you guys can take the worst part of Iraq and beat it. And so now they're supposed to want to arm these guys and pay these guys and integrate them in the way that Petraeus could never get them to when he had 150,000 people in the country.
Exactly. It's important to remember that the Iraqi military that you see now in Iraq is the product of years of U.S. training efforts when the U.S. was in Iraq in full force when it was occupying the country. And it's also the product of billions of dollars in training and arms. So to think that the U.S. can kind of sweep in and even in a few months, a few years, kind of build up an army that could take on the Islamic State is not something that inspires a lot of confidence at the moment.
Yeah. Well, now, and I'm sorry, cause I always go on and ask too many questions or allude to too many topics in one thing there, but back to the question of whether you think Abadi is even interested in trying to make this kind of a deal. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that we have seen signs that Abadi is trying to do something, that he is, trying to improve upon the legacy that Maliki left him with. The latest instance where we saw some real kind of change in policy from Abadi was actually getting this budget passed through Iraq's parliament. And that showed that he was able to really kind of reach out to the Kurds in a way that Maliki really was unable to do in last year. There wasn't a budget for the entire year, and that meant that a lot of government employees in Iraq's north and Kurdistan weren't receiving government salaries, and that created a lot of animosity between the Kurdish north and Baghdad. But with regards to the Sunnis and building trust with Iraq's Sunni community, I think it's really important not to forget that Abadi did appoint a member of the Badr organization, and this is a Shia militia with the, who's been accused of horrific human rights violations against Sinise, to head the Ministry of Interior. And that's a big move, an important move. And it's one that Human Rights Watch has called tantamount to institutionalizing militia rule.
Yeah. All right. Now, we're going to have to hold it right there. Sorry to interrupt. It's the break. We'll be right back with Susanna George, writing at the Global Post. You can also find it at theweek.com. America building a Sunni army in Iraq to take on the Islamic State. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show. And hey, look, I actually did the slightest bit of work and found a better bio. Susanna George does radio and print journalism for NPR, PRI, Global Post, and Foreign Policy. A little bit better introduction than the first one there. This article, I will direct your attention to theweek.com. It's also at the Global Post. America is building a Sunni army in Iraq to take on the Islamic State. And now where we left off, you're talking about how Abadi from the Dawa Party, the new prime minister, has appointed a leader of the Badr Brigade to be the new interior minister. And I think we're both kind of just sort of shrugging at what that portends pretty much inescapably, right? Oh, I'm sorry, Suzanne, I hit the wrong button. Start again. My fault.
Yeah, I think by Iraq's Sunni community, that was seen as a real slap in the face, because this is a ministry that is very powerful and controls a budget which it uses to buy arms that is comparable to that of the Ministry of Defense. So it's a very it's a power ministry, and for it to be led up by a member of an organization that so many Sunnis associate with, wrongs committed against their people, sectarian wrongs. I think it was definitely seen as a step back for Abadi in terms of his efforts to reach out to the Sunni community and kind of rebuild trust.
Right. And I forget, I'm sorry, before the break, if you mentioned the Human Rights Watch or the Amnesty statement there. Amnesty just did a report, of course, about how this is still ongoing right now. It really has been going on all along, the sectarian cleansing of the Sunnis, but now it's all kicked back up again since the declaration of the caliphate. So the Badr Brigade is, no one's even arguing that they're reformed and their days of power drilling people to death are long gone.
Well, I don't know about the continued use of power drills. But I do know that they are one of the most effective fighting forces on the ground right now against the Islamic State. They've had a string of victories in Diyala province. Some of those have been with the help of the Kurdish Peshmerga. Those are the Peshmerga, the Kurdish fighters in northern Iraq. And they're winning. Where in other parts of Iraq, in Anbar, around Mosul, it's the front lines are pretty stagnant. So the Badr organization is getting a lot of support from Baghdad. They're getting a lot of weapons from Baghdad and from Iran, although the Badr organization does claim that all of their support from Iran goes through Baghdad first. None of it comes directly from Iran. That's what the organization's leaders claim.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, one of my favorite questions for reporters on this war is to try to gauge, and I know it's kind of silly to try to put a quantity on a quality, but if you could, on a scale of 1 to 10, could you compare what you think is the power of the Islamic State over Iraqi Sunni stand now compared to the power of Al-Qaeda in Iraq at its height back in 2006? Because you know, there's a lot of hope there, right? People look back and say, hey, the local Sunnis got sick of Zarqawi's guys after he was killed, and stabbed them in the back and got rid of them relatively easily, within the space of a year. So maybe we could replicate that. And I just wonder whether, you know, how it is that you gauge their relative strength.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's a really interesting question, but I think it's very difficult to ask, to answer numerically.
Right.
These are two very different organizations, with two very different, kind of end goals. And, while there is a lot of hope that, that Iraq's Sunnis, after seeing the brutality of the Islamic State and seeing that life under the Islamic State, has gotten a lot worse for them than life even under a repressive sectarian Maliki policy. You know, from Mosul, we just hear horror stories of what life is like in Mosul now. Just zero society, zero government services. Crete, the other major city that the Islamic State controls, has, I believe the last estimate I heard was that only 1% of the civilian population remain in the city. So there's a lot of hope that the Sunnis will see these kind of poor living conditions and then turn against against the Islamic State. But what you're still missing in that is someone that will then back them and give them the weapons necessary to fight back against this very heavily armed group that's now managed to gain really important footholds in urban areas where U.S. coalition airstrikes aren't as effective as when the group was, you know, out moving around in these big convoys in big open areas of the country.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, all this brings us back to the question of what the Americans are doing with, even to the degree that they're backing this army of, even to the degree they're backing the Kurds and backing the Iraqi government, as well as this Sunni army that they're building here, of what their policy is and whether it coincides with reality at all. And the biggest question, of course, being whether Iraq is a place anymore, whether such a thing exists. We've created George W. Bush's stan, a Shia stan in the south from Baghdad down to Kuwait. And they don't seem to have much interest in attempting to rule Sunnistan. That was why they never incorporated their forces, because they said, you guys can go to hell, basically. Those days are over. It seems like the declaration of the caliphate, if nothing else, even if Baghdadi and the whole thing dies and the whole thing falls apart tomorrow, it seems like this is still the final declaration of independence of Anbar and I'm sorry, all the, I don't know the names of all the provinces up toward Mosul and in the predominantly Sunni areas of Iraq. It seems like, and you talk about this in the article, how if the policy really is holding Iraq together and this works, this could undermine that, because we're talking again about creating a separate Sunni army outside of the jurisdiction of Baghdad. So what Iraq are we even referring to anymore at this point?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll try to back up a little bit and answer kind of the first part of your question and get to the policy part.
Sure.
So what I saw at this base that I visited was a pretty routine visit by, you know, a small group of U.S. officials who are meeting with Iraqi personnel, and they're, you know, just assessing what their needs and wants are for, you know, this eventual fight to retake Mosul, retake territory that the Islamic State holds. And originally, this was planned, this plan to rearm Sunni fighters was going to fall under this big piece of legislation called the National Guard. And at the time that it was first introduced, this was a time when Baghdad was really asking the U.S. to up its involvement in Iraq, you know, to increase airstrikes, to increase support of Iraqi military. And so Baghdad kind of warmly, or maybe lukewarmly, responded to the U.S. proposal of creating a National Guard that would create a unified military for Iraq that would include Sunnis and Shia and Kurds and would help to heal some of the sectarian rifts that allowed the Islamic State to come into Iraq in the first place. At the time, the U.S. referred to it as a cornerstone of U.S.-Iraq policy because it was a way to kind of rebuild this trust. But since then, it completely just languished in parliament in Baghdad. And to be fair, Iraq's parliament does not pass very much legislation at all. And the Iraqi parliament members who I've spoken to said that even though Baghdad sounded as though they were open to this plan to begin with, they never thought that this National Guard plan was ever going to go anywhere. So the problem with arming these disparate groups without kind of a legislation, without a big piece of legislation kind of holding everything together, is that you have these Shia militias. You're going to have these kind of armed Sunni groups at one point. You have the armed Kurdish fighters. But the problem is that the Baghdad can then turn off that supply of weapons whenever it wants. And so there isn't any kind of long-term trust building that will go along with arming these disparate groups. And then even further down the road is that once, this fight with the Islamic State is over, if it ever is over, you're left with, military that's really just a bunch of militias, who then will lack a common enemy. And I think that that's what analysts, and a lot of Iraqi civilians are really worried about, in terms of their country's long-term future.
Right. And of course, we don't even have a chance to talk about the western half of this war in what used to be eastern Syria now, but maybe another time. I sure appreciate your time on the show, Susanna.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Susanna George, y'all. She's at the Global Post and also at Public Radio International and National Public Radio. And I'm late. We'll be right back with Jason Ditz right after this. Hey, all, Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, yeah, she was great, huh? I'm going to keep my eye out for what she's writing. I asked her there in the chat thing whether she was ever interested in writing very much about Muqtada al-Sadr, and she said, yep, that's her next big thing that she's writing. Oh, good. I'm very interested in the story of Muqtada al-Sadr and the role he plays in Iraqi politics. Very interesting person there. That is blood-soaked monster. I ain't saying that. I'm just saying I'm interested in him. All right. Hey, check it out. I got the great Jason Ditz on the line. Thank goodness for that. Hey, Jason, how are you, man?
I'm doing good, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us today. Everybody, you know Jason. He's the writer of all important news stories all day, every day at news.antiwar.com. He's the news director there, something like that, right? And, man, you got to read news.antiwar.com. Obviously, all the top headlines there are just bookmark the thing. And all day, every day, the best write-ups of all the breakingest news and all the most important news with all the most important parts that you need to understand highlighted for you with links to the original sources and the rest. And just worth his weight in platinum. And he's a big guy. All right. So, and I'm just assuming platinum is worth more than gold right now, but I don't really know. And in fact, he could tell you that because he's also a financial writer, too. Jason, I like you. All right, now, let's talk about some news. I don't want to know or care anything about this Korea movie thing, and I know that you probably don't either, but I know that you've already put yourself through learning everything about it so you could explain it to the rest of us, so please do tell.
Well, Sony made this movie called The Interview, which they put a little over $40 million into creating and tens of millions of dollars into advertising. And it's basically a comedy. Seth Rogen goes to North Korea to interview Kim Jong-un and is recruited by the CIA along the way to assassinate him while he's there, because apparently that's a thing. And North Korea expressed their usual outrage at any movie / video game / anything else that includes North Korea in it. Somebody hacked Sony Pictures, leaked a bunch of their content, did huge damage to their servers. the U.S. is saying they're convinced it's North Korea, but they don't really have any evidence to support that because they're saying the attackers weren't in North Korea. But they think, if nothing else, North Korea was probably supportive of it. And that's apparently good enough. But with this movie coming closer and closer to release, it was supposed to be... it was supposed to come out today at a couple theaters and then general release Christmas. The hacker group, whoever they happen to be, threatened to 9/11 all the movie theaters, which is insane.
You know this is just Matthew Broderick in his bedroom goofing around. What in the world?
I know. This is... I mean, first of all, what does that even mean to 9/11 all the movie theaters? Are they going to literally crash planes into every single movie theater in the United States?
And who's going to do that? North Korea?
Yeah.
They got sleeper cells all over America ready to attack, huh?
I mean, even if North Korea is behind this, which there's some doubt about, they certainly aren't capable of attacking every movie theater in the United States. And whatever hacker group they're working with or is working on their own certainly isn't capable of that. But insurance premiums being what they are and all insurance policies saying we don't cover terrorism, a lot of the big movie theater companies bailed on the movie and said, well, we're not going to show it on Christmas.
Oh, man.
And Sony deciding that... nothing was better than something, said, well, if the big theaters aren't going to show it, we're not going to release it at all. And, in fact, they went so far as to say not only are they not releasing it in theaters, there are no plans to even bring it out on DVD, which seems even more ridiculous because...
They're going to 9/11 all our houses.
Yeah, what are they? They're going to attack every DVD player in the United States? I mean, that's just even more ridiculous.
Oh, man.
But for now, Sony is just saying, well, we're going to just sit on this movie forever. And I'm sure they'll come around eventually because they put too much money into it not to. But
man. So, you know, this whole thing about the Sony hack started as a story that I'm seeing in the margin of all the things I'm reading, but I don't care about. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Some producer said something about some movie star that I don't care about, you know, big deal kind of thing. And now they've gone and made it a thing that I have to pay attention to. And what they've done, Jason, if I'm reading you right, if I'm hearing the story that you're telling correctly, what you're saying is that the Americans are doing everything they can, I guess, or the theater companies, the corporations involved here, the insurance companies involved here, are doing everything they can to show the world that there's no one easier to push around than the crybaby, tiny, little, helpless American people. Absurd is what Benjamin Netanyahu called it. It's worse than that. If a non-existent threat from a hacker who probably does not represent the state of North Korea, which could not attack America in any sense, in any way, or threaten American movie theaters in any way, can get an entire movie pulled from being released at all due to just a threatening email that could shut down an entire movie across the country. I mean, that is just, somebody called it the Twilight Zone, but that's not right. This is like Krusty the Clown Show. This is just beyond the theater of the absurd. I don't understand. I must not understand. What did I leave out? What did I miss? Did they actually, like, kill somebody? Did they do something?
No.
To somebody?
They just hacked Sony and then sent them a threatening email, like you said, and then that was all it took.
Oh, my God. Yeah, Fitzy G's saying the whole thing's a publicity stunt anyway. It very well could be. You know, I was just reading a thing about, I had no idea what it was I was reading, Jason, but they made reference to how during World War II, they even had a slogan for it that you're supposed to memorize. You may know it, the cliche for it about something about a stiff upper lip or something along those lines, about how Brits, when a V-2 rocket goes off and kills 200 people, they're supposed to go about their day and go get a pint at the pub and be brave. Because what are you going to do? Bow down and quiver and cry in front of Hitler and the Nazis? No. Right? And so 40,000 people died in the terror bombing of the Battle of Britain. 40,000 people were killed. And they didn't go and just sit and adopt as a national policy, flogging themselves and crying and being the biggest baby that they could. And I'm sure there was a lot of crying over and a lot of grief, but it wasn't adopted as a national policy of, oh, boo-hoo, what victims we are, for crying out loud. And this is unreal. I can't even believe what you're telling me. This sounds like the plot of some stupid movie.
It really does, and... I mean,
I'm sorry. I should come up with good questions to ask.
What? It's just so absurd. I mean, North Korea literally threatens to attack the United States and to wipe out the United States several times a year.
Yeah, yeah. At least every April. You know, they never miss an April.
Every April, there's the U.S. South Korea joint war games along North Korea where they pretend to attack North Korea. North Korea gets all riled up. Everything calms down when they have to send their troops back to start planting crops so they don't all starve to death, because their collectivized farm system just flat out doesn't work. And if they didn't use the military to plant crops and harvest them, half the country'd starve. But they come up with these idle threats that nobody takes seriously anymore, but somehow Sony does.
Man. Yeah, it's amazing to me that the way all the theaters reacted to this, too, instead of saying, yeah, right, I'll tell you what, we'll post an armed guard, you know, well, something easy, I don't know. But anyway, what a joke. Well, when we get back, I'm going to ask you probably one more question along these lines, which is about, you know, what you know about the origin of the actual Sony hack, for what interest it is. And then we'll talk about important stuff, like maybe some Palestine or some other things.
Hey, Al Scott Horton here.
For the Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for the Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Talking with Jason Ditz from antiwar.com, news.antiwar.com. And we're talking about this North Korea thing. Apparently, you know, a bunch of right-wingers are saying we got to go to war with North Korea now, which brings us back to the question. Jason, do you know of any reason to believe that North Korea has anything to do with this, really, at all?
Not at all. In fact, North Korea denied having anything to do with it, which... I mean, okay, then they say, well, they're probably lying, but when has that ever been North Korea's MO? They always brag about everything they do and half the stuff they don't do.
Right. And all the threats are coming from the same people who did the hack and not from any other North Korean known origin or anything like that.
Right.
And that's it. Okay. Yeah, you know, somehow I'm still not convinced. Okay, well, next question. So what about the State Department influence in here? I actually saw a tweet yesterday from an AP reporter said, well, I have sources in the State Department who say it's not true. But something from these emails say that the State Department gave at least an okay on this. What about that?
Right. And
on the production of the movie, which is the plot is killing the dictator there.
Right, and it goes farther than them just giving the okay to it. The Rand Corporation actually had a advisor/consultant for the creation of the movie, and he lobbied really hard for them to leave the successful assassination plot, spoiler alert, at the end of the movie in, even though Sony was like, well, we might get some flack from actually assassinating a foreign world leader at the end of a movie. And the Rand Corporation thought it was a good idea to leave this in the hopes that it would inspire North Koreans, who were obviously never going to see the movie in the first place, to actually assassinate him.
Really? And that was the purpose of it. It wasn't just that, well, we don't have a problem with it. Yeah, go ahead. What do we care? I don't know. It wasn't just... Yeah, you know, we like the idea of spreading the meme out there in the world that, you know, Kim Jong-un died, but but they specifically thought this will inspire North Koreans to turn around and kill him if only they see a movie like that.
Right. Right. Seth Rogen is all it's going to take.
Hmm. Yes, there's something very absurd about this all, I think. All right. Well, speaking of absurd, that is, like I mentioned earlier, what Benjamin Netanyahu says about American support for his government. Oh, yeah, they support us like 80%. It's absurd. The Americans, they're easily moved, he said. Oh, yeah, you can go watch the video of it on YouTube if you get a friend who speaks Hebrew to translate it. But I don't think anybody's really disputed the subtitles there. We can all go and look at it ourselves. That brings us to Israel's relationship with the Palestinians, which is, of course, entirely wrapped up in American foreign policy in every way. There's no way to pretend that this is just like, I don't know, if there was a border dispute in Mongolia somewhere or whatever. This is which that would probably be America's fault too somehow. But this is entirely America's responsibility here, the U.S. government's responsibility, the situation going on there. And there are a lot of new developments here. And the latest headline you have at news.antiwar.com, Jason, says Geneva Conventions invoke rights of Palestinians, but Israel insists Geneva Conventions don't apply. How so?
Well, they're arguing that this is in particular about the fourth Geneva Convention, which covers the treatment of civilians under military occupation, which, of course, would include the Palestinians because they're under military occupation. Israel's argument is, well, they're under military occupation, but the question of sovereignty over the West Bank and Gaza is so murky that it shouldn't apply. Because it's not like we just invaded and occupied. We've controlled this territory for decades and decades. The Palestinians never had an independent state, and Jordan doesn't want the West Bank back, and Egypt doesn't want the Gaza Strip back, so there's not a opposition faction claiming legitimate sovereignty over that territory. So their argument is, well, then the Fourth Geneva Convention just doesn't apply.
Well, but then even according to that bogus argument, couldn't Abu Mazen or Abu Abbas, they call him, what's his name, whichever, the leader of the PA, he could just say, you know, I'm declaring myself the leader of a state. This is a state, and we want all these rights. Wouldn't that undermine that entire argument right there without Egypt or Jordan being involved?
Well, it does, and they have. The Palestinians have claimed sovereignty over this right. territory.
But they don't even address that. The Israelis don't address that in their argument? Or they say that doesn't count.
The silly argument is that there's no historical basis for an independent Palestine, so they can't claim their own sovereignty.
Okay. Well, that's completely ridiculous. And the law didn't recognize that. Of course, the Ottoman Empire used to rule Palestine. They're saying unless the Ottomans had created an independent state and set it free back when, or if the British had before they gave it to the Israelis, then that would be perfectly fine then. And then they would, of course, have the right to invoke the Geneva Conventions and our military occupation of their territory. But since the Ottoman Turks never gave them their own state back when, then that means we don't have to recognize their rights today.
Right. And that's basically it. And the conference, which the U.S. boycotted because it was about Israel, and they boycott anything that's about Israel that Israel doesn't like, found that, yes, the Fourth Geneva Convention does apply in the occupied territories, which is important because Israel is violating that on numerous counts. The big things in the Geneva Convention are no collective punishment. You're not allowed to conduct any population transfers from the occupying state into the occupied territories, which is exactly what the settlements are.
Right. And no, that's the excuse they're claiming is, listen, we're in the middle of stealing this territory, so it's murky. We're occupying it. We're colonizing it. We're taking it from them. So how can they say it belongs to them when we've gotten away with it so long so far?
Right. And that's the whole point of the Fourth Geneva Convention, is that you're not allowed to do that. But
I know a lot of people get emotional about this, Jason, but I would just ask people in the audience who were just, you know, reacting against this, you know, knee-jerk fashion, to just stop and consider for a moment if it was the other way around. If the Palestinian, Muslim, and Christian Arabs had rounded up all the Jews and forced them into the Gaza Strip concentration camp, or colonized them and built these giant walls to imprison them and treat them as at least, you know, fourth or fifth or tenth class citizens of one degree or another there in the occupied West Bank. If it was the other way around and it was the Palestinian, Arab, Christians, and Muslims doing this to the Jews, Americans would be absolutely freaking out. Well, same difference. It's the exact same difference. That's all it is. And in fact, you know what, Americans? You know, the Jewish Israelis, more of them might look white and European like us, but you can't speak their language any more than you speak Arabic. So what the hell? Why should Americans defer to the Israelis in this situation when they're the aggressors, when their excuses are laughable because they're lying, because what they're doing is wrong and it's so obvious on its face all day, every day? It's wrong for Americans to continue to pretend that the poor Israelis are the underdogs in this damn thing. It's just not so.
Well, right. And, I mean, historically, this happened a lot. Historically, occupying neighboring lands and then colonizing them like this is how states grew. But this is not the Middle Ages. This is not the way things are supposed to work anymore. And the Geneva Convention, the whole point of them is to spell out that things like torturing occupied civilians, expelling populations, creating colonies, those things aren't to be done anymore in a civilized world. But Israel does them openly and insists that this situation's just too murky to criticize.
Yep. Well, you know, I know the excuse is wearing thin. In a lot of places, it seems like people are pretty much just over, you know, any kind of expectation that the American-led Oslo-style peace process thing is ever going to kick in. So it's a new day. I don't know what's going to happen next. I know a lot of people are pushing for a one-state solution. Or different routes to two states, but it seems like there are going to be big changes, politically speaking, anyway, if not the facts on the ground here coming soon. Oh, well, what do you think? The EU just recognized, took Hamas off the terrorist list today. That's indication of something there. Anyway, I'm sorry. I don't always phrase things in the form of a question, Jason, and obviously we're out of time now, too, so sorry about that. Thank you for your great journalism all the time, man. You do great work.
Sure, thanks for having me.
That's Jason Ditzel, news.antiwar.com. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.